Welcome to the first Q&A session in Nemeta. So we've got a few questions that were put on the Q&A thread in the Treehouse forum, which you've decided to address.
We've selected some. Others have been answered by other members of the staff, and I thank you for your responses.
And we've also got a couple of questions that came in via email that John's going to address after the ones that are on the forum. So, first question. It came from Ken. What is enlightenment? What exactly is enlightenment? And after attaining enlightenment, what is next?
What is enlightenment? It's not exactly the right question to ask. The right question, the appropriate question is, what is this enlightenment that I can have now, right now, in this moment, in Kali Yuga? One of the points I make in the exposition of the Dragonfly Sutra is that the enlightenment that can be your experience now, right now, is different from any previous kind of enlightenment. So what is this enlightenment that you can have now? It is simply the lucidity that naturally accrues in your mind from observing how your mind works spontaneously. Both when you observe it and when you don't observe it. And the Dragonfly Sutra, which consists of 11 lines and 55 words, is actually an instructional tool to bring you to that lucidity. This instruction is a unique product of this moment in time. It is a unique product of the Maitreya event. And nevertheless, it can be related in certain ways to the previous tradition of Buddhism. But I make a very strong distinction between traditional Buddhism, or the carrot on the stick type of Buddhism, and the Buddhism of non-attained realization. So what you're going to have through the Dragonfly Sutra is the non-attained realization of the mechanism of your own mind, period. That's all that it is. It does not entail having experiences of bliss. It does not give you imperturbable serenity. It has nothing to do with morality. It has nothing to do with good behavior. It has nothing to do with anything that is traditionally associated with the achievement or attainment of enlightenment. It is a completely new breakthrough of insight into how the human mind works. And that breakthrough happens in the framework of the Sophianic Gnostic teachings.
Does this come into play then, that thing that the Gnostics taught, that at the end of Kali Yuga all religions and spiritual teachings would be rendered useless?
Yes, but the Gnostics didn't teach that. There are certain tantrikas, certain tantrics who taught that. Particularly you look at the Maha Nirvana Tantra, which for 95% of it is a bunch of gobbledygook and gibberish and junk. But there are certain small gems in it. And in one of these gems, it says that at the end of Kali Yuga, very special and unique opportunities for, quote, spirituality, unquote, become available. And this is one of them.
So Ken kind of answered his own question. He said, I suppose the obvious answer to what comes next is correction. Would you say this is part of correction?
Not necessarily, no. And in another way, it is. There are certain ideas, certain concepts, but not many, that you need to take on board to approach this experience of non-attained realization. In the first place, you have to know, you have to be secure and comfortable with what non-attained means. You have to be comfortable with the idea.
What does it mean?
It means that I can't give you a nose because you already have one. If I told you that I'm going to be the spiritual teacher who shows you how to attain your nose, how would you regard me? If I said I was the spiritual teacher who shows you how to attain the sense of smell, but you already have the sense of smell. The enlightened mind is contained within the deluded mind. Even Buddhists of the Zen and Chan schools say this. Buddhists of the traditional carrot on the stick schools do not say this. So the teaching that I can offer regarding enlightenment has, in some respects, a foreshadowing in the Chan and Zen schools, and you can forget about all the rest of it. And I will be citing some really wonderful and delightful Chan and Zen teachings in this respect. In regard to the second part of this question, well, what do you do once you've attained enlightenment? Samsara and this enlightenment have the same look. You don't do anything because you're already enlightened. What are you doing now? What are you doing now? Do you think that what you're doing now will be different after you attain enlightenment? No. The reason why that is not so is because you cannot attain it. All you can do is come into a comfortable and confident experience of the enlightenment that you already have. Now, granted, if you come into that, there will be momentous changes in your reality. And I could talk about that for a long time. But basically, I'll tell you that you'll be more lucid, your sense of mental oppression will fall away, and you will be far more capable of receiving Dakini instruction when you have the accumulated lucidity that comes from the practice of the Dragonfly Sutra.
Great. That kind of leads into the last part of Ken's question about how to survive in a toxic wasteland and fend off transhumanism, climate change, all those other lies that we live with on a daily basis.
That's all the same for all of us, and it doesn't change anything in that respect. We're all warriors in a terrifying battle zone, in the fog of war, of confusion and delusion, manipulation, deceit. Doesn't change any of that. It does, however, profoundly change your appreciation of what your own mind actually is and how it operates. And it gives you mastery of your own mind. And with that, you can do as you like.
Question two, this came from Jeffrey. What is going on with Mantis? What is Mantis's current role or effect in correction?
I don't know, and frankly, I don't care. I have to tell you about Mantis. There are certain aspects of my work that I am not able to follow up on, like some of the themes, some of the issues and topics in the GNA. I am not able to follow up on due to the limits of time and to the limits of being or appearing to be just one individual. It would take a team of people to follow up on the clues that I've laid. First point. Second point is, I'll tell you honestly that there are some themes that I've introduced and some clues that I've produced that I myself do not find productive to pursue any further. And I have to say that for Mantis. That's not to say that someone in the course of time might not discover something about Mantis that would be delightful, entertaining, and instructive. But it's not going to be me, and I don't really have anything more to say about it.
Okay, another question from Ken. This was about the idea of immortality from the Nag Hammadi Library. Immortality, the luminous child versus reincarnation.
Look, don't get hung up on this immortality thing. There is no personal immortality. You, as a single self-identity will not survive. In fact, you don't even survive from one second to the next. How are you going to survive from one life to the next?
Well, you're going to elaborate a little bit more on this subject in a later question, which is one that came via email from the Kali Yuga course. So question four came from George and his Zoom meetings, how to visualize the app.
Don't visualize the app. That's like saying how to visualize. I have over there on the table a compass, which I use to draw circles and which I use to do, for instance, you can divide a circle into six parts with a compass. You can draw different, you can draw the golden section, the Fibonacci series. I do certain operations with the compass. I don't visualize the compass while I'm using it. It's just a tool. You don't visualize the Shakti Cluster app. All you have to know is that you hold in your hand an interactive device like the zapper for a television and just learn to use it in concrete terms. You don't have to visualize what it is.
I'd like to add to that. There's been times when I haven't had the physical app with me and I've needed it. And so I've then visualized, but I've visualized the object in my hand and used it for what I wanted, and it worked.
Well, that's a good point. But to even make it more clear to George and others who struggle with this, you're not picturing anything. The beautiful reality of the app is that the icon of the app has the special property of grounding you into the telluric field of the planetary animal mother. That's exactly what it does. You don't have to embellish it or do anything with it in your imagination. You just have to learn to use it like any other tool. So be patient with yourself.
Question from Jen. She'd love you to comment on walk-ins.
Why? What's interesting about walk-ins? I'll tell you that I know I met in my life one walk-in. And he walked in to my office in Santa Fe, the balcony office off the plaza, sometime around 1988, 1989. And his name was Bob Frisell, if I remember correctly. And Bob Frisell was a friend of the woman who rented the balcony offices, who allowed me to use it for my classes and other purposes. And at that time, I was doing something with people, offering some kind of service. I had packaged the Seeker's Handbook and sold the package of the Seeker's Handbook in a certain way. So a couple of people came to me to ask for advice about how to market and sell certain ideas that they had. And Bob Frisell came to me. And Bob Frisell later claimed to be a walk-in, and he appeared in the New Age vaudeville show as Drunvalo Melchizedek, calling himself Drunvalo, and not anymore, I don't think anymore, I think he's totally passé, but for a considerable period of time, Drunvalo Melchizedek was all over the internet. And what was his shtick? His shtick was peddling the flower of life, which is nothing but a Kabbalistic scam. It's a Kabbalistic scam. So I only know one walk-in, and I would ask Jen and anyone else this question. Why are you interested in walk-ins? Name one walk-in who ever contributed anything, anyone who claims to be a walk-in, who ever contributed anything of substance or enduring significance to the human situation. I can't think of one.
Question six from Constance is how to calculate the moon's nodes.
How to calculate them? Well, I don't know, because I don't have the astronomical formulas. If you want to go into astronomy and into the mathematics of astronomy, and you want to study how to do that, you can find a way to do that. But I just go and look at the ephemeris, which is apparently what you did as well. You looked at the ephemeris and you saw certain things. So what did you see? Well, you saw that there are two moments about 9 months, 9 years and 3 months apart. That is to say, a full cycle of 18.6 years. In that full cycle, there are two moments. One, when the moon crosses above the ecliptic, and the other, when the moon passes below the ecliptic. Okay? Now, why do I say, obviously that happens every month, why do I say 18.6 years? Well, the difference is that these two nodes move backwards in 18.6 years. So, for instance, currently, when the moon passes from below the ecliptic plane of the Earth to above, it passes at a point around 10 degrees of the sign Cancer, is in the twins. That's the north node of the moon. And the south node, when the moon passes below the ecliptic plane of the Earth, is in 10 degrees of Capricorn. And that happens every 15 or so days as the moon makes its cycle.
Because the moon moves backwards every day.
No, the moon doesn't move backwards. The moon moves forward around the Earth, and as it does so, because the plane of its orbit is at an angle to the plane of the Earth, it goes above and below the plane of the Earth. Imagine two plates, two round dinner plates, that are locked together at an angle. The angle is about 8 degrees, so it's a very slight angle. So you visualize these two plates. Half of one plate is below the other, and the other half of it is above. That's how the orbit of the moon works. But those two points also rotate in time. And every 18.6 years, they make one complete revolution. So now, right now, as we're speaking, what is it, November 2019, the north node of the moon is located in 10 degrees of Cancer, which is 100 degrees of the ecliptic, which is in the twins. And 18.6 years ago, it was in the same position. And 18.6 years from now, it will again be in that position. So that is called the rotation of the lunar nodes. How do you calculate that? I have no idea. I rely on the astronomical experts who calculate it, and I just read the tables. You also asked the question, and it's a great question. It shows that you're an observant student. Can that astronomical data, which we have to go to an ephemeris to find, be observed? Yes, it can be observed and has been observed, but it must be observed by teams of people who work diligently and consistently over many, many years and record their findings. Then they can go out into the sky and they can look at where the moon is and they can know by observation that it is either above the ecliptic plane of the Earth or below. So it is possible to determine it by observation. And of course, the ancient civilizations, such as the Maya, the Aztecs, the Egyptian, the Chinese, did so. So I might add here something that comes up while having this little conversation off stage. The movement of the moon, planets, and even the constellations is a continual dance. And the experience that you have as an observer is to step into the dance while the dance is happening. Imagine that there were people on a dance floor dancing, and you step in and merge your motion with the motion of the dancers. This is what you have to do. And sometimes there are subtle movements that combine more than one movement at a time. So when you're observing the moon at any evening, let's say ideally looking west, let's say the crescent is growing in the night sky, you're seeing two things at once. you're seeing the moon move from right to left through the sequence of the constellations, Ram, Bull, Twins, Crab. But at the same time, you're seeing that tableau of the constellations move from left to right. So while it is moving from left to right, the moon is moving against it from right to left, and that is the dance, that particular dance.
The next question comes from a man called Jim. This was via email. He's presently studying Kali Yuga course, and he's on the Tablet of Destiny unit 8.101.3. So he has a couple of questions before his main question. If the only organic properties in this third arm is the earth, moon, and sun, why is...
Stop right there. It is incorrect to say that the only organic system in the third galactic arm is the one we're in. I never said that. We are in an organic system captured in an inorganic system. The organic parts of the system are the Earth, Sun, and Moon. The inorganic or archontic parts are the remainder of the solar system. This is a unique and anomalous situation. However, the Earth is not, I never claimed and I would not claim, that the Earth is the only organic planetary system in the third galactic limb. I don't know. I don't have direct proof or evidence of others, but I can tell you that it's very likely that there are many, many other organic systems as well.
Okay, so he wants to know why the inorganic constellation Scorpion, called Mother Scorpion, the path of rebirth, and why do dead souls go there?
All right. First of all, who says that the constellation of the Scorpion is inorganic? Did I ever say that?
No, and I can't say I've ever looked at the constellations thinking they're inorganic. They're totally organic.
Right. What are the constellations? You might recall something I said once, which was quite delightful. I've had this conversation several times. I don't know where you could find this written down, and I don't know if these conversations have been recorded. But I introduced the word casting. C-A-S-T-I-N-G. And I have stated, I think I said in the GNE, that the constellations are castings of aeonic imagination. And then I also have elaborated that concept by playing on the word casting, because the word casting has a number of different meanings. For instance, you can say, we are casting for a role in this film. Or you can say, the fly fisherman is casting for trout. Or you can say that a bronze sculpture is produced by the method of casting. So this concept of casting is a very powerful Gnostic metaphor.
And knitting, weaving, you cast on, you cast off.
Oh, is that
casting,
so?
Yeah.
It's even a metaphor, it's even a term in weaving.
Mm-hmm.
All the better.
Well, I don't know about weaving, but knitting, definitely.
In knitting. So appropriate. So the constellations that you see, well, I can suppose, I don't know, because unfortunately we don't have an opportunity to talk about this face to face, but I can suppose that one might have assumed that why? Because the stars are inorganic. The stars are not inorganic. I don't quite see the inference here. In any case,
perhaps it comes from the thing that the Archons, Sophia gave when they were in her hair bugging her. She gave them the opportunity to go off and create the solar system.
Right. The Aeon Sophia gave the spark of her mind to the Archons, who can create nothing or originate nothing. And she gave them the opportunity to create a Disney World theme park for themselves, which is the solar system. Which is the solar system. That's just the solar system. The solar system is a pinprick in the galactic arms. The constellations are living animations of the dreaming of the aeonic powers. They are the visual, sensorial instruments through which the aeonic powers register their own experience in our minds as a spectacular display which captures our imagination. There's nothing inorganic about the constellations. Regarding the other part of your question about Mother Scorpion, the quotation to which you refer, I've taken not from its original source, but I've taken it from Hamlet's Mill by Santayana and von Dekant. And I love that quotation because it refers to two things which I find to be palpably true. As a shaman, I can verify, first of all, the scorpion, the tail of the scorpion, is in the Milky Way.
Was
in the Milky Way. This is a tremendous change that's happening in the cosmos that some people have noticed. In fact, we were tracking it closely in the last couple of years down there in Andalusia. And others have also noted. Way, way back when I did skywatching tours in Santa Fe, I would show people that the constellation of the Scorpion, which is the only one that actually resembles the creature so named, the others, you know, the bull, the ram, the twins, they don't really look like what they're said to be, has a hooked tail, and that the body of the scorpion was emerging from the Milky Way around to up to its waist, which is the star Antares, at the heart of the scorpion. But now it appears that some of the Milky Way is actually dissolved. It's like the river or stream in the Milky Way is drying up. So only the very tip of the tail of the scorpion is now in the Milky Way. So why did I cite that passage? Because, first of all, I like it. I think it's poetically and mythopoetically beautiful. And it also preserves some form of indigenous shamanic wisdom. In other words, the Milky Way is the path of the warriors. So what does that mean? I don't entirely know. It's a poetic allusion. It's beautiful. Live with it. Savor it. But it appears to mean that the power of those who live as warriors on this earth goes when they die into that area of the Milky Way, which is actually the core. Because the center of the Milky Way is in a line of sight just above the stinger of the scorpion. So, in some manner, the power of those who live as warriors and shamans, when they die, is collected in the direction of the galactic core and then fed back again through other lives and other human animals who come to live, who pick up that power that was generated by those who lived before them. So there's a continual recycling of power, but there is no persistence of individual identities. Is that clear?
Yeah. Another part of his question was, does the anthropos that was created in the Pleroma have self-awareness?
Well, according to one Hindu teaching, it does. You know, the Hindu, it's not proper to call them Hindu, really. I realize that now. Hindu refers to people who lived by the Indus River. It refers to the population of the Indus River civilizations. More properly, I guess you could say Vedic. Yeah. So there are various schools, primarily there are six schools of philosophy and metaphysics derived from the rishis and from the ancient Vedic seers. And among those schools, there is at least one that claims that there is an entity called Purusha, P-U-R-U-S-H-A. And according to this Vedic teaching, Purusha would be the self-aware identity of the Anthropos.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, I haven't referred to this particular vein of Vedic teaching so far. I think this is the first time I've cited the term Purusha. One of the Vedic schools of metaphysics, I can't remember which the name of what it is, maybe it's Shankhya, claims that there's a primordial duality which is called Purusha and Prakriti, or Prakriti, Purusha and Prakriti. And that's kind of a variation of the Shiva-Shakta duality, Shiva-Shakti duality. But I haven't really played on that much. I don't like to foster that idea. And so, to answer your question more bluntly, you know, in the frame of Gayan Noetics, I would say no. The Anthropos is not self-conscious. The Anthropos is a plasm that doesn't have something comparable to what we could call self-consciousness. It's a germ plasm deposited in the Orion Nebula. If you want to get a good working concept of what the Anthropos in its primordial status is, then read the first chapter of The Parable of the Beast by John Bleibtreu, and you will find he gives an elaborate description of the behavior of slime mold. And slime mold actually behaves in an extremely brilliant and intelligent manner, but you cannot say that it is self-aware. So the Anthropos plasm in its primordial cosmic state could be compared to slime mold. Okay? The only way that it can become self-aware, or that it can have anything like self-awareness, is by differentiating into filaments. And these filaments then give rise to different racial strains. So it can become self-aware when it differentiates into a racial strain. And when the members of that racial strain appear in some planetary environment, when the members of that racial strain acquire self-consciousness, then you can say that by a series of stages, which the Gnostics called hypostases, or stepping down, that it becomes, in a way, self-aware. But no, in its primordial cosmic state, it does not have self-awareness unless you follow the Vedic teaching about Purusha.
Okay. Questions about the TI of the CW.
The TI of the CW. Always ready for that. So,
and you two know who you are. So one, where did the intel come of the TI needing to know about the strike?
Right. The intel about the Charlotte Working came from being on Charlotte's Ridge, came out of the earth, out of the telluric field, as a form of detectable DI, Dakini instruction. And when it came, being the one who received it, I had then had to construct the ritual. And in the process of constructing the ritual, I arrived at the view that it was imperative for the TI to know that she is the TI. And you could say that that is my conclusion as the shaman who was in the position to perform the ritual. I deemed it to be so in my attempt to get my mind around this ritual and how it would work.
Second question, do future KLS lethal strikes require the TI to know?
I really don't know. I'm guessing that, yes, that's probably the case. So I get it, as we're here talking off stage, that you don't think it's necessary.
No, I don't.
Okay, that's fair enough. I accept that. I tend to think that it's necessary so that the very mindset of the TI contributes to its own demise.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But we're only going to do these kind of things on psychopaths that are in the public arena. And how do we let them know? It's going to be the same problematic approach that we had with the TI.
You're absolutely right. In making that a condition, as I did, it was my calculated strategy as a shaman. True, in making that a condition, it becomes very problematical, because how do you get them to know that, considering the opportunities that we have through the media to reach them? It introduces a factor of near impossibility into the equation. So I'm willing to say, try it either way. I'm not attached to what I did or how I constructed the Charlotte Working. I do hold that, for the most part, it is true and correct and can be followed as a model. For the most part. What are you laughing about?
I'm smiling because you dropped a bomb on us recently. We had somebody visiting from Virginia.
Yeah.
And you dropped a bomb on us about the rigging of the TI. Rigging of the Charlotte Working.
I did?
You did.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, so I'm going to get him to elaborate further on that at another point. So this comes from Stefan, my German brother, about the Dragonfly Sutra. So this was written, and Stefan hasn't been taught the Dragonfly Sutra. So this was based purely on the Dakini Weather Watch, where you introduced how the Dragonfly Sutra has to be given and
recited and propagated.
And propagated.
And nobody so far has been taught the Dragonfly Sutra, so get that clear.
No, I've got seven lines.
Six.
Six lines, that's it. So, you were talking about the mind as a robotic machine. And so various people, he went and had a look, and various people have talked about the mind and how it works. One is Gurdjieff. This was a bad translation. It was a Google translation, I think.
Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff is famous for talking about the robotic character of human behavior and perhaps by implication of the human mind, but not necessarily. He was talking about the NPC, the non-player character behavior of human beings. Gurdjieff, yeah.
Okay, the other one was Krishnamurti.
Krishnamurti has also said a lot, which does not stand up, and is even more boring now than when he said it originally, attempting to talk about the mind in order to disarm people from their attachment to their own mental functions and to direct them towards some kind of open space of awareness beyond the mechanisms of the mind, which, in my opinion, he did not succeed in doing after an awful lot of jibber-jabber.
Jibber-jabber.
Jibber-jabber. Enough jibber-jabber.
Okay.
So, Stefan, I want to tell you and everyone else who's listening loud and clear that whatever you have encountered from one teacher or another about the human mind, the Dragonfly Sutra entirely excels and supersedes any teaching about the human mind that you have ever heard. And you don't have to pay attention to anything else. If you really want to know, how deep is your love? know, do you really want to know? Do you really mean to learn? If you really want to learn about how what you call your mind works, this is the way to do it. And anything else that anyone else has said is completely fucking extraneous.
Well, the 6 lines that I know of the Dragon Fly Sutra, there's certainly no jibber-jabber. It's clear as a bell.
Indeed. Indeed. And it has to be observed on the terms that it's given. Now, I'm sure everyone's wondering why I'm screwing them around in this way. I'm doing it not because I want to, but because I have to. I cannot not tell you that the Dragonfly Sutra is in this world. And I cannot not tell you something about how it works and how the recitation of it works. And yet, at the same time, I have not presented a full and complete exposition, nor can I ever. The exposition of the Dragonfly Sutra continues to the end of the Kalpa, and it is you who carry that exposition once I have done my part, whatever my part is. I'm doing whatever my part is. I'm pedaling as fast as I can. I am determined to release as much as I can of the exposition of the Dragonfly Sutra, including some demonstrations of recitation, which we'll do. I can't make any promises, but I can tell you that it is incomparable, and there has never been anything else like this. It simply describes how a dragonfly flies. But in contemplating that description, it simultaneously shows you how your mind works. Would you not agree?
Fully agree.
Right.
And then some.
And then some.
Great. So I would just like to remind members of Nemeta that this Q&A thing that we're doing is a really, really good opportunity for you to draw forth from John those things that he's never going to get around to finishing because he just doesn't have the time and the stamina a lot of the time. So let's get as much as we can out of the main professor via this Q&A.
Yeah, it's a good opportunity. I look forward to it as well. And we'll get better at it. I appreciate all of you who contribute to answering questions for others. That helps me a lot because that takes the load off me. And those questions that I can answer, I'll give it my best shot. Now, it seems to me, as we were discussing this before we recorded, that there were a couple of other things that we haven't touched yet. Have we touched everything in the notes?
Yeah, I mean, there were more, but I think you already answered them.
Good. So as we're coming around to the home stretch, I do want to say again, specifically, thanks especially to Dolma for quoting Quest for the Zodiac and for bringing in citations from my work as they're appropriate to answer some of the questions you've posed. And also, un grand merci à Stéphanie en France pour ses efforts dans la compilation de mes écrits et tout ça. So I want to thank Stéphanie for contacting Dolma with that material. And I think that about covers it. Well, there's one final point that I'd like to make. Is there any loose threads or anything we're missing here?
No.
Okay. Final point that I like to make is that when I say, for instance, that the Dragonfly Sutra in the teaching of non-attained realization that comes with it is sufficient unto itself, you can discard or ignore anyone else's teachings, whether they be Gurdjieff or Krishnamurti, whomever, I want you to really get where I'm coming from when I say that. I don't say that to assert the paramount exclusivity and delightful novelty of everything I teach. That should be obvious. That's self-evident. It's self-evident in what I teach. I don't have to proclaim it. I don't have to blow my own horn. When I say that not only what you get in the Dragonfly Sutra, but largely what you get in PT, Vata Shakti Cluster, and so forth, is sufficient unto itself. Don't mix and match with anyone else. Why do I say that? First of all, it takes time, and you don't have time to do that. Why would you need to mix and match with Gurdjieff or Krishnamurti when what I'm giving you is already sufficient to what you need? And the second point, and this is really the crucial point for me, you need to try to comprehend that the teaching of someone of genuinely high attainment goes to your attainment. It goes, I never speak down. That's why I say this is enough. I say that not as an arrogant statement about my opinion of my own work. I say that because it's enough for you in the attainment of what you already have. There's not enough time to go around and around the rosebush with all this stuff, like a dog chasing its tail around the rose bush. No. So when I speak of the sufficiency and adequacy of what I teach, I'm really talking to you about your capacity for attainment of what is innately yours. I take you to what is innately yours as long as you can't get there on your own. That's all I'm doing. That's all a real master of Chan or Zen ever did, which distinguished them from the other Buddhist teachers who like put you on a treadmill like a fucking gerbil. These practices, these doctrines, these teachings. So as I said to the people up in Stockholm when I gave this little talk on the 20th of October, I'm here to speak about the core and from the core, and I speak to your core. It's all core to core. That's all that matters. It's Kali Yuga, folks. We don't have time to fuck around. We don't have time for distractions. We don't have time to go and compare and wonder how this works with that. If you're presented with what takes you to the core, then take it in the way it's presented. That's my message to you.
Good enough. Jawohl, mein Führer.
So on that happy note, we'll conclude and look forward to another...
So we'll try and do one a month.
Yeah, one a month would be good. And until then, tatagate.
Tatagate.